Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started. Hello and welcome to the Grateful American series. This is an interactive multimedia project designed to restore enthusiasm in American history for kids and adults. We're here today with Susan Stein, the Richard Gilder Senior Curator and Vice President for Museum Programs. Welcome to the show.
And welcome to Monticello. We're glad to see you here.
Thank you so much. David and I are thrilled to be here. So let's tell the audience a little bit about you before we launch into our Q&A. Susan Stein is Monticello's Senior Curator and Vice President for Museum Programs. For more than 20 years, she has studied and written about Jefferson and Monticello. Her main responsibility is the Curatorial Department, whose staff researches the objects and lives of those associated with Monticello. She determines the physical presentation of the house, studies, acquires, and cares for the collections, and develops the exhibitions. She is best known for the landmark, The World of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello exhibition and book from 1993, and her work on the four exhibitions and film of the new Thomas Jefferson Visitor Center, which was completed in 2009. What an amazing history.
It's been exciting and thrilling to be here over such a period of time of great action here where Monticello has literally been transformed in many ways. And we're especially excited about what's underway as we speak. We are bringing back Jefferson's original road scheme, reinstating the kitchen road and kitchen path, which were survived until the early 20th century. So we're bringing that road scheme back. And we're also working on recreating two of the lost buildings along Monticello's Mulberry Row, which was the principal plantation street.
Isn't it true that not so long ago, Monticello was pretty sleepy as far as the public was concerned, and in the last 20 years it's really gained a public and a historical presence?
That's a great question and a great observation. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation was formed in New York City in 1923, and since 1923, about 90 some years, we've been restoring the house and also instituting educational programs here. And our mission is to engage the public in a dialogue about Jefferson's ideas. And things have really perked up, I think, since the mid-1980s, when I think there was a whole new interest here in bringing back more things, in creating an interpretive program which would engage audiences. And for the first time, we really started to talk about Jefferson's larger political contributions as well as his design of the house.
Okay, so getting back to Thomas Jefferson for a second, what would a typical day be like for him?
Well, Jefferson was engaged in many, many activities. And at Monticello, what he, I think, most often did was rise when he could see the face of the clock at the foot of his bed in his bedchamber with that bed alcove and the wonderful clock that was designed to his specifications and made in Paris in 1790. So he arose very early at dawn, essentially, and upon awakening, it was his habit to plunge his feet into a basin of cold water that would have been provided to him by his enslaved butler, probably Burl Colbert toward the end of his life, and earlier than that, a man named Jupiter. And then he would enjoy breakfast with his family in the dining room, and then he would come back to his private suite of rooms, which one visitor dubbed his sanctum sanctorum because it was off limits to everyone else. And he would write at his writing table, answering letters. He said that he drudged like a workhorse at that table, answering mail. And he wrote approximately 19,000 letters in his lifetime. So it's a tremendous effort on his part. So then he would go on horseback and ride to his farms, and he would inspect what was going on at his plantation. He would see things that were being grown. He would converse with enslaved people. He was in every way managing the plantation. And he was engaged in thought about the plantation and its activities.
Did he have any success as an entrepreneur?
Oh, many people have asked this question. And I think that he was entrepreneurial, but we wouldn't say that he was successful monetarily in the way that we term people successful today. Right, I don't think so. He died in debt owing about $107,000. So we couldn't say that he prospered, at least at the end of his life. And it left his family with a lot of financial responsibility to pay off his debt. And indeed, in 6 months after he died, virtually all of his possessions were sold here at a famous dispersal sale in January of 1827, in which his belongings were sold. And that included household furnishings, farm equipment, the contents of his kitchen, and sadly, the enslaved people that he owned.
So let's talk a little bit about Jefferson's relationship with his slaves. It's a controversial topic for a lot of people. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I think that slavery is really the unsolved problem of the American Revolution. And Jefferson devoted his life to achieving the ideals established in the Declaration of Independence of liberty, equality, and self-government. And liberty and equality were, I think, in some ways more achievable. They were more achievable rather than equality, which is what we expect. So Jefferson expressed the noblest ideals of our nation, but slavery prevailed. And in Jefferson's time, in 1790, for example, 20% of the American population was enslaved. In Virginia in 1790, about 293,000 people were enslaved. So this was a massive national issue. And Jefferson himself was a lifelong slaveholder. He understood how wrong slavery was. He called it an abomination, a blot, a deplorable entanglement, yet he did not free his slaves, except for five who were, there were a limited number who were freed. And he believed that slavery would be resolved and should be resolved as a national issue, that individuals could not resolve this larger problem. And indeed, the Civil War was fought to resolve that issue, and it wasn't something that was resolved in Jefferson's lifetime at all.
Was he kind to his slaves?
People often ask that question, and I think that he was known to be kind to people. And I think what that question really is getting at is, what was the nature of slavery at Monticello? Was it violent here? And by its very nature, slavery is a violent, coercive institution, or was a violent and coercive institution. And Jefferson tried to ameliorate slavery at Monticello to make it better for individuals and their families. And he did so by shifting from barrack-style housing to individual houses for enslaved people. And he hired overseers who he instructed to be not to use the whip. He wanted enslaved people to be motivated by doing well and being rewarded for it. But that wasn't always true here, and there were particular overseers who were much more violent than Jefferson would have liked.
He had this on-again, off-again friendship with John Adams, who had no slaves. Did he ever consult people like Adams to try to resolve his ambivalence about to free or not to free?
I don't know of a discussion that he initiated about it. I think that there is a famous letter that someone named Cole wrote him in 1812, because he was a Albemarle County resident, and he decided to free his slaves and to help them move west. And he asked Jefferson to do the same, and Jefferson decided not to do that because he didn't think that it would solve the larger issue.
Speaking of controversy, tell us a little bit about his relationship with Sally Hemings.
What most historians believe now is that Jefferson had a sustained relationship with Sally Hemings for a long period of time. Some people debate when the relationship began, but it certainly began by 1798, when a child was born to Sally Hemings, and the father is thought to have been Jefferson. And she gave birth to six children, and historians now think that all of them were probably fathered by Jefferson. Two of them, Madison and Esten Hemings, were freed in Jefferson's will. The other two surviving children, Beverly, a male, and Harriet, a female, were given their time or were allowed to leave Monticello in 1822. And so we think that her children got special treatment. And in fact, the Hemings here were, I think, the largest enslaved family. Their matriarch was a woman named Elizabeth Hemings, who was Sally's mother. And there were Hemings enslaved here over five generations of that family. And many of them occupied the most important positions and proximity to Jefferson and his family. So they were trusted, they were very trusted members here of the community here.
And Elizabeth had an affair with Martha Jefferson's father, is that correct?
We think that John Wales, who was Martha Jefferson's father, had a relationship. We would say a relationship with Sally Hemings' mother, yes. And she herself was the daughter of an African woman and an English sea captain.
And there was a child from that union, wasn't there?
That was Elizabeth Hemings. That was Betty Hemings, Sally's mother.
Fascinating. And I believe that Jefferson met Sally when she brought his younger daughter over to Paris when he was there.
He in fact knew her earlier, because it was said that she helped care for Martha Jefferson in her final illness, and she died in 1782. Jefferson and his wife were married in 72, and she died in 1782.
And in fact, one of the other slaves that he freed was James Hemings, who he took to Paris with him to be his chef to learn French cuisine.
That's correct.
And then he had a sad end to his life.
That's right. It's thought that he committed suicide.
And is there some understanding about why that might have been?
I don't know enough about what's presumed about his psychology to answer that. But I think that he was a troubled individual.
Yeah, and it goes back to the complications of the slaves and the free slaves. And
I don't know about that.
So tell us a couple of things that people don't know about Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, gosh. I think that people, many people probably don't realize that he was both politically creative, but also artistically creative. We think of Jefferson as the founding father because he's the person who articulated our ideals. But most people probably don't realize that he also gave shape to America's public architecture. And he was committed to seeing self-government succeed. And everything he did in his life was to achieve that end. And one of the things that he wanted to do was see Americans respected in the eyes of the rest of the world. And having an ennobling architecture was one way, he thought, that America could achieve respect. So he designed the Virginia State Capitol, that wonderful neoclassical building modeled after the Maison Carrée in the south of France. And that was widely copied in America. So he fashioned America in a sense. He fashioned its political ideas and ideals, but also fashioned the way America would look. And a contemporary architect, Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who was one of the architects of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, wrote that Jefferson planted the arts in America. So I think that that's something that people don't realize.
You talked about Jefferson's sanctum sanctorum, writing letter after letter after letter. How do you think he would feel about Facebook?
How would Jefferson feel about Facebook? I'm not sure how. I have no idea how he would think about Facebook, because I think in some ways he would probably like the idea that you could communicate with people so effectively and so easily.
I mean, all these things like Facebook or LinkedIn, I mean, they're, you know, contemporary versions of building these networks, which he like to do, I suppose.
That's such an interesting question. I want to really be able to deliberate about it. But it's a great question to ask my colleague, Jeff Looney, the editor of the Jefferson Papers, because I think a lot of Jefferson's correspondence was meant to be private. How transparent would any of the founding fathers want to be is a very interesting question. How much, I think a good deal of their correspondence is probably something that they would want to take advantage of a network to communicate ideas. But there's also the behind the scenes political operation that he probably and would want to be private.
But he didn't burn his letters.
He didn't. I think that his correspondence he understood to be his legacy.
And he would make copies.
He made copies, and he owned two different kinds of copying presses. He made one that was made by James Watt, known for the steam engine. And he owned another that was made by Isaac Hawkins that was more of a double-acting pen kind of copying press. But the reason that we know so much about Jefferson today is that so many of his letters survive. And since at least 1950, they've been studied, they're being edited and annotated by teams of historians who are making these letters accessible to the public, and it is very exciting. And when you asked about things that had changed, we at the Thomas Jefferson Foundation are putting many more of our resources into making these letters accessible. We took on the editing and publication of the retirement series of the papers of Thomas Jefferson here so that we would be able to edit both projects. The main project is headquartered at Princeton University and the retirement series here. So the project will end sooner, and it means that historians and everyone throughout the world will have access to all of these letters earlier. It's a great achievement, and many of these letters now are accessible online through a project at the National Archives. It's not only Facebook that's improving access to this material in another way, but the internet is a great tool. And there are all kinds of resources on Monticello's website, by the way, to engage students and teachers and help provide exciting materials in the classroom and beyond.
We're excited to talk to Jeff Looney about that when we go over to the library for our next episode. Talk a little bit about the room we're sitting in, this beautiful, gorgeous atrium that's right off his bedroom. Right?
Yes, we're sitting in a conservatory, and it's where he sprouted seedlings here that were planted in his garden. It's where he also had a workshop. It's said that he liked to work with his hands, and it is adjacent to the Sanctum Sanctorum. And that private suite of rooms that Jefferson occupied consisted of his bedchamber, his cabinet or study, and he referred to it as by both names. And we've found out, you know, through more research that there was probably a sofa in one of these rooms. So we know that there were family members who were probably coming in from time to time. And then adjacent to the cabinet was his book room, where his outstanding library, where much of his outstanding library was stored. And adjacent to that was a family sitting room. And this room was right off the book room. And no one was really allowed in these spaces unless they had been invited by Jefferson. They were really private. And Margaret Bayard Smith, the wife of a Washington newspaper editor, came here in 1809 and wrote a rich account of her visit. And she remarked about, it's she who sort of labeled it the Sanctum Sanctorum. Another visitor, a woman named Anna Thornton, complained that the doors to the Sanctum Sanctorum were closed, that complained that no one could really gain access to it. So he, I think, husbanded his energies here. And he lived here, of course, in his retirement years with his daughter, Martha Jefferson Randolph, and her children. There were eight in 1809. When he retired, so eight in 1809 or 1810, and she gave birth to three or four more children after that time. She, I have to note, gave birth to her first child in 1790 and her last child in 1817. So Monticello, this is by way of saying that Monticello was populated by his family. His daughter and grandchildren lived here. He also lived here after 1811 with his sister. So he wanted his privacy with so many grandchildren, let's say eight living here at any given time. He probably wanted the solitude.
When he died, he died in 1826, and his death was actually, in a way, competitive to John Adams, since they died on the same day. So it wasn't like he died and that was the only presidential information of the day. How did having two presidents die at the same time affect the way in which he was grieved, maybe, by the country?
It was a phenomenon that they died on July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years after the Declaration was presented and approved by Congress. So it was regarded as being cataclysmic, really. It was just phenomenal. And that's what filled the press when people learned about it. And at the time, when Adams died, he believed that Jefferson was still alive, but it seems that Jefferson actually predeceased Adams. And Jefferson held on until about 1 p.m. in the afternoon. He had been sick for days, in and out of consciousness, and his grandson-in-law, Nicholas Trist, was the one who told him that it was the 4th. So everyone understood this to be a dramatic moment. And I think that if a playwright had been trying to conceive of an end to Jefferson's life, it could not have been eclipsed by what actually happened.
So we're in this beautiful room. Can you tell us more about the house?
I'm delighted to talk more about the house. When people visited Monticello and people referred to it in its time as the curiosity of the neighborhood, there was nothing like it anywhere. And it was Jefferson's achievement to create this house. He designed and considered every single aspect of it. And people refer to it as his autobiography. And I think of it really as that, because everything tells you something about Jefferson and what mattered to him and how he functioned here. So from the very moment that you glimpse the east portico upon your arrival, visitors then would have been struck by this unusual building because it's neoclassical. And there are virtually no neoclassical buildings like this in Virginia. So it's a big statement. And it's obvious that he has been inspired by ancient architecture, by the architecture of Rome, and that he has put it into play here on Virginia's frontier. It's a portico facing the wilderness on the west side, because that famous west portico with the dome that he added later is the iconic image of Monticello that everyone recognizes from the Nickel. But if you look at the east front, there's a portico there. And that portico looks to Rome, to what influenced Jefferson. So it's a great way of understanding Jefferson, just to look at the house, because you're reminded by what he learned, what he studied, and how it influenced him, and also looks to the future and the West and to America's future, which he defined in so many ways. And then when you come inside, or when visitors came inside, they would have been dazzled and struck by the museum, in effect, the proto-museum that he created in that hall, where it was filled with natural history specimens, with sculptures by Houdon of Turgot and Voltaire, to sculptures that were Native American, some created in 1500, excavated in Tennessee, and brought here to Monticello, where they were displayed. Old master paintings, a model of the Pyramid of Cheops, the Declaration of Independence, portraits of himself. These are all things which would have been so striking, because most Virginia houses only had portraits inside.
He seemed to be very focused on symbolism and the beauty of what he's seen and reflecting that back. So that you see that when you travel around the house and you see the beautiful portraits and the sculptures and the people that he felt were so influential.
Yeah, I think that what Jefferson was trying to do was to educate his guests, his friends, and his family. And his overarching purpose in his life is to sustain the American experiment in self-government. And he believed that self-government depended on the informed participations of every citizen. So educating people was something that he took seriously. And this was an opportunity to educate people about influential thinkers, about Western civilization, about the history of North America, about the people who shaped American history. There were portraits here of numerous portraits of George Washington, of James Madison. There was a portrait, two portraits of James Monroe. Of John Adams, of Alexander Hamilton, the influential thinkers were represented here. I think that he felt that the experiment in self-government was fragile, that he was always worried about whether or not it could continue. So that's why he devoted himself to, let's call it political and educational awareness, but it's why he also participated in the American Philosophical Society. While he was president, he was the head of America's principal scientific organization. And there has been no one who equals Jefferson since then, no president who was literally an architect, but also architect of American life. And that's all what you see here. And this is a functioning plantation, 5,000-acre plantation, that's the source of Jefferson's economic resources, his wealth, but it's also a place of education for his family, a place where for us, for slavery to be understood and discovered here, and that's an important part of what we do today. But it was at the heart of his life, especially in his retirement after 1809 and until his death.
So as you go through the house, you go through the beautiful museum, fascinating museum, and then you walk through his library into his bedroom, and then you go into the parlor where he ate and spent time with his family and received guests. Talk a little bit about that part of his day.
Well, Jefferson was visited by many people, both invited and uninvited. So the hall was the place where most people were received, the entrance hall or hall. And then if you were staying to a meal, you might have been invited into the parlor. And that was one of the main social spaces. That's where the walls were crammed with pictures and portraits of Washington, of Madison, of Adams, and also of the three discoverers, of the discoverers of America that he admired and believed that people should know about, as well as the three greatest men who ever lived, he thought, Locke, Bacon, and Newton. But in the parlor, this social space was where his family would gather for tea, perhaps in the late afternoon or early, or have some refreshment after supper. It's where they read in a circle. It's where all the social occasions were. But all of this was meant, what Jefferson's idea, what shaped this, was that he really aimed to lead a cultivated life. And that meant cultivated in the sense of being educated and cultivating public taste, but also there was an experience of the finer things in life. And in the dining room, dining with Jefferson was renowned.
So tell us about his dining room.
So the dining room was where Jefferson entertained, and he was famous, if not renowned, for the dining customs there. At table, there was cuisine served half Virginian, half French, in good taste and abundance, someone wrote. And French cuisine was notable. He had French-trained chefs after 1784. All of those who cooked at Monticello were trained in the arts of French cookery. And they were enslaved people. The first was James Hemings, who studied French cooking in France, and then he came back and trained his brother Peter, and that tradition was passed on and ultimately resided with two young women, Fanny Hearn and Edith Fawcett. And they accompanied Jefferson to Washington and were trained by his French chef there.
I admire Jefferson's passion for wine. Tell us a little bit about his experience with wine and how much he said, famously said, "I cannot live without wine."
Jefferson was recognized in his own time as an aficionado of wine and really an expert. He advised others about which wines, and people wrote about it. He used dinners in Washington, as John Meacham has written about in his book, The Art of Power, to really cultivate friendships. And people wrote about him serving wine, and this was highly preferential to what had been the American custom before.
But didn't he get a little help from Dolly Madison about how to do that?
I can't document that, so I don't know the answer to that. I know that Dolly Madison sometimes served as a hostess in Washington, and so did Jefferson's daughter, Martha Jefferson Randolph, but both women only occasionally. So Jefferson was very much on his own in terms of setting not only the ideas of the young nation, but also the style. And he was his own host, and in Washington he entertained at then the president's house. Often people sat at an oval or round table. There was no hierarchy there. He liked people to sit pell-mell, not by social rank or station, and there were some famous incidents as a result of that where people thought they might have been snubbed because they weren't seated where they thought they should be seated.
So, Susan, the objects that are in this house, which came from all over the world, how did he get them here?
Well, Jefferson had unusual access to goods from around the world. And one of the things that he envisioned for America, why he opposed the British, is he wanted Americans to have access to global goods without the middleman, the British middleman. So if Jefferson opposes tyranny, he opposes tyranny of taxation, of economic tyranny by the British. He opposes imposition of state-supported religion. What fills Monticello are goods and furnishings and artworks from Virginia, second from the Mid-Atlantic states, things that he acquired when he lived and worked in New York and Philadelphia. And then he had a few things that were made in London. But Monticello's character was greatly influenced by the things that he brought back from France. He served for 5 years as an American minister in France, in Paris, and he brought back 86 crates of things. Actually, 96 crates, if you count the 10 crates that he brought back with him in 1789. So there are lots of things from France coming direct to Monticello. And it's what gives Monticello its cosmopolitan character that you don't really find in American houses or homes so much. Although after the French Revolution, some French cabinet makers and artisans come to America and live in Philadelphia.
So when you walk into the parlor, you see those amazing portraits. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Jefferson believed that Americans should know about their history. So he encouraged American artists to paint American historical subjects. For example, John Trumbull and the Declaration of Independence was actually begun in Jefferson's house in Paris. But Jefferson also obtained portraits of key people in American history. And he thought that our country should not be without its discoverers. So he had portraits of Columbus, Vespucci, the map maker, Amerigo Vespucci, Magellan, Cortez, and Sir Walter Raleigh.
And then there are portraits of the founding fathers as well.
Yes, there are. And we have been trying to locate, in fact, you know that what we do as curators here is try and locate all of the things, all of the furnishings, all of the artwork that was here at Monticello in Jefferson's lifetime. But when he died in debt in 1826, his belongings were dispersed. So at least since 1923, we've been trying to trace those things. So what you see is the culmination of decades of work. And in fact, it began even earlier. The family of Uriah Levy purchased Monticello after Jefferson's death, and they too tried to reassemble the Jefferson collection, or what had been here.
How much isn't here of the original, percentage-wise?
I couldn't say. I wish I could answer that finitely, but I think we probably just roughly, of what you see now in the house, about 60% actually, 60 to 65% actually belong to Jefferson. But how much is missing, I would say, is probably half as much. And it was a much more crowded house than we show it now, just because we don't have everything. But some things survived largely intact. For example, the furnishings in the cabinet are pretty much intact from Jefferson's time, the furniture, because his family prized those things so greatly that they never really left the family's hands.
How long did it take to construct Monticello, and what was the process?
Well, Monticello's construction took over 40 years. Jefferson began a little bit before 1770, when the foundations were dug for the house. And the first house that he began, we call it the first Monticello, was very much derived from his study of Palladio's architecture. Jefferson was a self-taught architect, and he turned to the Villa Pisani and the Villa Cornaro, which were both double-storied dwellings in Italy designed by Palladio with porticos, double-storied porticos. And he was influenced by another building with two L-shaped wings called the Villa Saraceno. Jefferson only knew these buildings through the four books of architecture published by Palladio. So Jefferson didn't ever finish the first Monticello. In 1784, when he left for France, it was still unfinished. And once he got to France, he was very much influenced there by new Parisian buildings, many of them with domes. So when he came back to the US in 1789, he had an idea to expand Monticello. And remember that his wife had died in 1782, so he was expanding it for himself. And it went from a small building, from essentially 8 rooms to 23 rooms. And it was inspired by these buildings that he had seen in France. Chief among them was a structure called the Hotel de Salme, which is now the Museum of the Legion of Honor, adjacent to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. And it had a dome. And if you look at that building, you'll see that there are a number of similarities. So the dome was one of those features. Jefferson also added skylights. He changed the function of the house. He finally got around to building the two L-shaped wings, which submerged the dependencies below. That's another project that we've undertaken, and I hope that you'll have a chance to look at those rooms and see the kitchen, the smokehouse.
Can you tell us about the furniture here?
So Jefferson had a lot of furniture that he ordered from Virginia, made in Philadelphia and New York, and from Paris, but there was also furniture made right here at Monticello. Some of the people who helped build the house were extremely talented joiners and cabinet makers. And after the construction of the house was largely complete in 1809, they turned to making furniture. So we have quite a few examples of Monticello joinery furniture, which we prize. And some of it, we believe, was made by enslaved joiners such as John Hemmings. And it was John Hemmings, distinguished member of the Hemmings family, who took over as head joiner here after the hired white Irish joiners left in 1809. So John Hemmings succeeded them, and John Hemmings is thought to have made quite a bit of furniture for Jefferson and his family, and a good deal of it survives.
Thank you so much for your time, Susan.
It's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming to Monticello, and I hope that you will enjoy your stay this week and come back soon.
Absolutely, and we'll send lots of people back too.
You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults too.